Last Sunday, we looked at the only Jesus to be found in history. One who went about making such astounding claims, you're brought to a startling altar. Either Jesus was a nut, a fraud, or what he claimed to be, which is as good a definition of God as anyone needs. All authority, source of all authority. What he says needs no objective criteria other than the supreme, eternal authority said it. No man can make that kind of claim. He thought he was perfect, and if perfect, only God can be perfect. We all fall short of that measurement. Other founders of religion claim visions of the eternal world, or in the Eastern religions where eternity is undefined, undifferentiated nothingness, they claim to have touched it, which is the experience of nirvana, and their karma that keeps them rolling in this area of appearance stops and they live it out and become one with ultimate reality, but it's based on having experienced an unconscious state in spiritual pursuit of such. He talked of eternity with first-hand knowledge, having been there, here temporarily, and going back. No mortal man can speak that way. He thought there was something wrong with the whole world. It could only be set right by him. He personally was the center of the religious experience, the center of the religious universe. He did not teach a way apart from himself. Every other respected religious founder based it on something outside of himself. Confucius, a logical, empirical analysis of society. The Gautama Buddha, personal experience he had and the way to work into that experience, which is all he would leave. Muhammad, visions. Only Jesus of the respected group made allegiance to himself, and himself indeed the center of the religious universe. I'm the way, I'm the truth, I'm the light, I'm the water. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. Any other route, thief and a robber. Follow me, not my way, follow me. And the ills of this world could only be righted by his death. And he unabashedly accepted the designation of John, behold the Lamb of the world, in a context where the Lamb had to be pure and spotless as the sacrifice for sins. He spoke of his death as ransoming the world, in a context where the word meant to restore a lost inheritance, or where the unclean destined for death was spared because of a ransom, a price paid for redemption. And then astoundingly, he claimed that when he died, he'd rise again the third day. These are such claims that anyone who called Jesus a good and wise teacher reveals by that very statement they don't have knowledge of the only Jesus to be found in history. He can't be good and wise. He can be good, if nuts. I mean, there are good nuts who believe the not only will you hear things here you won't hear from Jerry Falwell or Pat Robinson or the traditional preacher. This ain't a traditional audience either. Honest nuts can believe the impossible about themselves, but they believe it. In every dimension of life, they can be good, but stupid, crazy, believe in the impossible. He can be wise, clever enough to make people believe that he indeed had these qualities, but to be wise, he knows, is not true, but he's clever enough to carry it off, thus he's not good. He can't be both. People just have a hard time finding the guts to call Jesus a nut or a fraud. I'll hand it to the Jews of the first century. Oh, there's a great move on now. And I was ironically interested last Sunday to go home and find that once again the public television was playing the series Jesus to Christ on Sunday afternoon, last Easter Sunday. One of the features in that series of scholars and academics who are seeking to say that a simple Jesus of Nazareth was created subsequently as the Christ. One of them was John Dominic Crossan, who is perhaps one of the two key people in the Jesus Seminar who's written this massive tome, The Historical Jesus. No question for what he is, a profound and hardworking scholar, but with an a priori frame and mindset that just cannot accept the miraculous. To accept Jesus as God is to accept miracles. To accept Jesus as God is to accept what at least the country western singer Charlie Daniels accepts in that song, Joy in the Morning, that John just sang. He came out of the tomb. And coming out of the tomb gives the hope that his other promise, he will come again to set this whole world right from beyond history. Even Reinhold Niebuhr, the profound neo-Orthodox theologian, recognized that the basic truth proclaimed of the New Testament is that the answer to history has to come from beyond history. God has to enter into history and set it right, which is what Jesus, with the powerful proof message of the resurrection, that he is God, gains credence in that other claim as the two looking on at the announcement or at the ascension time announced. Why do you stand gazing into heaven? This same Jesus that you see going up into heaven shall come again in like manner. A ridiculous claim, unless the resurrection's true. A ridiculous claim, unless in like manner they witnessed him indeed go up. These are astounding claims. And if those claims are true, we have a definition of God. You don't need mystical four-out. Nobody knows what a Trinity means. It's a logical nonsense. I've written the creed for one denomination and helped rewrite it for another one. I can recite the Nicene Creed. The Trinity is an article of faith. It is logical nonsense. You cannot. You accept when you state it that we have inadequate linguistic tools to define the nature of God. And as Paul Tillich has said, it's almost as blasphemous to define God as it is to deny him, because you bring him down and put him beneath our limited linguistic and conceptual ability. It's an article of faith. Nobody knows what it means. Anybody says they know what the Trinity means reveals how stupid they are. The incarnation is logical nonsense. The whole Western universe is built on the concept based on Aristotelian philosophy, A cannot be A and not A at the same time. It's either A and not A, here or there. It can't be A and not A at the same time. The Incarnation proclaims, based upon the resurrection, that allows us then to hang our faith on statements that we don't even understand, can't really put into words. Because the Incarnation claims Jesus was God, A, and man, not A, at the same time. In all respects and all the time. That's the basis of all the fights of the early Middle Ages and the early church councils. Trying to find logical sense in a claim of faith. Can't make sense of it. He was God and man in all dimensions, A and not A, same time, all the time. And it's just as blasphemous to deny his humanity as to deny his divinity. It's a proclamation of faith. We now see through a glass darkly, as Paul said. We can't bring God into time and measure him and size him up and understand him. But the one who can tell us all we need to know about God, the claim of Christianity is, and I've got to find a way to get behind this, that though no man has seen God, whatever he may look like and be, Christ had declared him, exegesis, brought him from behind the curtain and put him on display. And all we need to know about God, he showed us. It isn't all that God is or all that eternally can be known. But all that we need to know about God, he brought him from behind the curtain, put him on display, and when you've seen me, he said, you've seen God. Doesn't mean you've seen all of God, but that which you see is God. And that's all we need to know about God. He came, struck a tent in human flesh, and led God forth and put him on display. Those ridiculous claims make him a nut, a fraud, or what he claimed to be. And the whole issue stands or falls on the resurrection. It isn't just that he raised from the dead, or that he ascended, and the message was threefold. He came out of the tomb, as prophesied. The tomb was empty, a fact of history. He ascended, and the message of the New Testament church was both. Not just resurrection. Resurrection and ascension and an empty tomb. And it's not just that he rose and ascended, though that's mind-boggling, but that the one who made these other claims, including the prophecy of his death and resurrection, claiming he'd come out of the grave, that the one who made these startling claims is the one who came out of the tomb. The package makes this the center point of history. And that's why Paul says, if Christ be not risen, our faith is vain. Furthermore, we're false witnesses of God, but we declared of God that he raised up the Christ. It was a discouraged, broken band of disciples at the crucifixion. The resurrection produced the change. And every early message was the resurrection. On the day of Pentecost, as Peter came down from the upper room and preached to the mob, on that first day the church was born, you killed him. You desired a murderer to be granted unto you and killed the Prince of Life. But God hath raised him up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be holden of it. He's still preaching that in Jerusalem, and the rabbis and Pharisees and Jews arrested him, ordered him not to preach the resurrection. Peter said, "Do we obey God or man?" You hanged him on a tree, but God raised him up. And I've already mentioned Paul, who said, "I delivered unto you first of all," in 1 Corinthians 15, "that which I also received, how that Christ died according to the Scriptures, and was raised again the third day. After that was seen," and he names them in a list, Peter and James, and above 500 brethren at once. Witnesses that could be gathered. Not all of them still alive, for he said some have fallen asleep. Their archaic phrase for died, but some are alive and well as he's writing this message. Witnesses that could be gathered who saw him after the resurrection. And the entire Christian ministry, the entire Christian proclamation, the entire message that Jesus came to reveal would have died. Would have died the day he was crucified without the resurrection. The resurrection gives credence to his claims. He's neither a nut or a fraud, but indeed God eternal. The resurrection is the basis for it all. Now the world argues, and the reason these scholars keep coming out with these tomes trying to find some other explanation. A resurrection cannot occur. That's a given. You're not going to be respected academically running around saying, "I believe in miracles." Resurrection cannot occur. Therefore, anyone who says it did has to be lying, and a poor reporter who doesn't deserve being read or must be credited with some kind of fantasy, because the resurrection cannot occur. Therefore, it didn't occur. Anyone who says it did is lying, or at best, suffering delusions, because that's a poor reporter who's not reporting facts, but fantasy, because resurrection can't occur, therefore it didn't occur. Anybody says it did, not worth reading, because resurrection can't occur, therefore it didn't occur. And therefore, anyone who says it did, not worth reading, because the resurrection can't occur, and we must find a way to explain the reporters, because it couldn't have happened. There has to be another explanation. Christianity says, we know it can't occur. It's what makes it so significant. We know that it slices like a meat cleaver into the stream of ordinary things, and is the most astounding thing to occur in the course of history, that one who came and made these claims, verified, as Paul said to the philosophers on Mars Hill, the claims of coming out of the grave. If that happened, we have to examine his claims, including the claim the only route to heaven was obtained by him. Whether God lets you in some other way, the basis is still the one who gave his life to purchase the whole field, to get the treasure out of the field, those that God wants. The resurrection's everything. After years of being driven to this startling alternate, either he's a nut or a fraud, or what he claimed to be, and the resurrection settles it one way or the other. I settled in on, what's the evidence of the resurrection? Now, for starters, I did an undergraduate history major precisely to gain the tools of historiography. And I learned quickly there is no such thing as historic certainty. Historic certainty, by definition, all logically possible pieces of evidence are available. And logically, though not actually possible, logically possible, eyewitness. And since none of us can be an eyewitness to any historic event that's already gone, Historic certainty, by definition, is relative, because there's always some logically possible evidence not obtainable. So all facts of history are relative, based upon the weight, accuracy, and convincing quality of evidence. You make historic decisions by looking at evidence. Now, there's a certain probability that some things are not true. I mean, if history records that Clinton had all those women the same night, probably not true. Maybe. And probably not true to such a degree it's hardly worth spending 3.5 years proving it up or down. You follow me? Maybe we shouldn't go there. I mean, we could spend 3.5 years to prove that point. And what do we got? It's probably not true that Jesus came out of the grave. Just at first glance, forgetting the intelligent people for 2,000 years who've looked at evidence and been convinced, that begins to weaken the probability negatives. But I give the point that for one to raise from the dead, particularly one who said he would, the probability is pretty low. But the consequences, unlike the Clinton analogy, the consequences are so astounding, if true. Your whole life must be affected. That means it's worth at least 15 or 20 hours of looking at the evidence, because there's plenty. Yet the facts are, even in the Christian church, except those that go here, I mean, you've heard more than 22 hours yourself. You've been here for 22 years from me. But even the Christian church, very few people have looked at the evidence. It abounds. And I've said repeatedly, I can respect anybody who looks, remains agnostic, though that's the easy way, cop-out, or is convinced it didn't happen. I just haven't found anybody. Academics, ordinary people, in a lifetime, once I, in college, zeroed in on this, I haven't found anybody that denies the resurrection, but what I can ask them a handful of questions and know they've not really looked at the evidence. They have concluded the probability is so low, the impossibility of it is so high, there's got to be another explanation, it's not worth looking. So there's very little disciplined look at this, which if true, the most important fact of history. You can never have historic certainty, but you can have psychological reaction. Psychological certainty is something that happens to you based upon exposure to evidence. If you haven't looked, you're driven by probability and opinion. Exposure to the evidence, like sitting on a jury, you reach a stage where something convinces you. No longer are you agnostic. You get convinced, guilty or not guilty. You have to expose yourself to the evidence. It makes this Sunday's message dangerous, which is why I sort of tread water before I jump into it, because if I do it inadequately, some of you will go away and say you've looked. Well, here's a little book. There are some, but I've yet to find one who's read this book, Who Moved the Stone? Written by one who went to Palestine determined to demythologize Jesus and take the myths out of it and find the good and wise, respected, high moral example Jesus without the miracle hodgepodge. And he went there to disprove the resurrection and the miracle stuff. He ends up writing one of the most convincing proofs. Who Moved the Stone? Frank Morrison. Sherlock's Trial of the Witnesses. The weight. For years, those that have not wanted to believe have argued there were no eyewitnesses and the writers of the Gospels were frauds. That it was second or third century, and then they moved back to the beginning of the second century. That these Gospels were written by someone other than the name attached to them. But archaeology has uncovered now, at last count, I don't know how many sits I last looked, but P96 is the list of 96 papyri. We have, you can look down the room of the book, P45, Chester Beatty manuscript, which has all of the Gospels, mid-second century. We now know that there was a proto-Matthew, a Matthew written in either Aramaic or Hebrew, but with Hebrew letters, being circulated among the Ebionites. Jerome refers sort of confusingly to the Gospel of Hebrews, which he says was written by Matthew, that he says he translated, along with some others, the Nazareans, another early first century Christian group that had only a gospel they attributed to Matthew written in Hebrew letters. There used to be some who thought that might be the Q document. There's been a big stir recently about a find at a monastery south of Jerusalem. The secret gospel of Mark that has an ending a little different. There's lots of quarrels about the ending of Mark's gospel. But this one became the basis of a cult. And the only record we really have of it's quotations from the fathers, primarily a letter written by Clement of Alexandria referring to it. We have now underneath the gospels in the first century, multiple Gospels circulating, which explains why Luke said, there are many that are trying to record the record, and I'm deciding to sit down and do an historic unfolding. This little book. Wonder how many of the disbelievers have read Eyewitness to Jesus, resting in the college at Magdala, the Magdalene Fragments. This little book, a man, a German scholar who had married an English lady, on a holiday is visiting the college and goes in to see three little papyri written on front and back, Matthew's Gospel, 26th chapter, the anointing of Jesus and the betrayal of Judas on the other side. Someone had dated in the second century, way back in the 50s, and nobody paid any attention to it. He was a great papyrologist who went in to look at them and stirred the whole world as he dated these papyri. And the whole book explains the science of papyrology and how it was done to between 60 and 70 A.D., and we know Matthew used Mark, and these proto-Matthews were before that. And Mark's gospel had to be written before Matthew because Matthew used him. If that's dated in the 60s, Mark's pushed back to within 20 years. And he was a young man because it was at his mother's house that the Last Supper was held when Jesus died. So we're pushed back into the 50s. by the Magdalene fragment and the cave at Qumran, which also happens to be photographed in this book, the cave at Qumran, number 7, the 7th cave among the Dead Sea Scrolls. You'll see this on the screen. It's called 7Q5, lines from St. Mark's Gospel 6, 52-53, the fragment in the Qumran cave. Get straight on it if you can. All these critics of Jesus who try to date him as the creation of later frauds who write Gospels and put the wrong or a fraudulent name on it, ignore totally that seventh cave of Qumran. Now, those manuscripts were hidden. Before Tatian destroyed Jerusalem, and the community at Qumran was wiped out by the Roman soldiers. That puts the caves and their contents, not the caves, but the contents, were hidden before 68, at the very latest, 70 A.D. And they have a fragment, not of a scroll, but a codice, a codus, codex. Like we have Sinaiticus Codex, or Codice, which is book form, rather than scroll. And prior to scroll form, they had a thing called Siticus, or Silicus. When they were in scroll form, like you go to a library, you don't have to open the book to see what the contents is, the binding of the book lets you look quickly and see author and subject. Follow me? Well, scrolls had to be identified in their delicate way with something that kept you from unrolling them all the time just to see what it was. So the equivalent of what is now the bindery of a book was a silicus, the Greek word, siticus, two different words, siticus and silicus. This was a little fabric, papyri, leather, or something on the handle of the scroll that would identify. Now, if there was only one gospel circulating, which when Tatian did his Diatessaron about 170 A.D., which he harmonized the gospels, and that was used by some of the Eastern churches as the only gospel, a harmonized gospel. And if there was only one gospel, this little Siticus would say, Eulogium, Evangel, Evangelion, the Gospel, Evangelion. That's all they need. You know, you got the Gospel. But when more than one began to circulate, and it is very clear to the scholars that Tatian, when he did his harmony, also used a fifth Gospel. Some thought it might be Gospel of Thomas. Most people believe it was one of these proto-Matthews, the Gospel of Hebrews, which is quoted quite extensively among the patristic writers the first century or so. Second century, first and second century patristic writers, and Jerome extensively. So he had a fifth one. So as these were accumulating, which they had to be by 170 A.D. for Tatian to do a harmony, you had to add another thing to the Siticus. You couldn't just say Evangelion. It had to be the Gospel, good spell. It had to be the good spell of Matthew or the good spell of Luke. And they'd have on this Siticus in the Greek letters Gospel Matthew, Gospel Luke, Gospel Mark. Now, if they're circulating among the churches as early as 60 and 70 and 80 A.D., there ain't no way you could have pseudonyms. Gospel of Matthew, with Matthew still running around loose. Gospel of Luke, with Luke still running around loose. Gospel of Mark, with Mark still running around loose. Not written by him. Try getting on the shelves of the library down here and sign your book, Gene Scott, and see what I'm going to do. I'm trying, as I move to the point of the day, to say this is not a subject that you just brush off with an opinion. I see Croson over here giving more credibility to the Nag Hammadi finds, the Gnostic Gospels, than the Gospels of the New Testament. 5,000-plus manuscripts from Westcott and Hort through the current accepted best of the scholars, Nettles Holland, Greek Testaments now that have a language all their own, little symbols, a circle, following words left out, a little box, a T, and other words inserted in some of the manuscripts, and in fine detail at the bottom, all the manuscripts, 96 papyri, hundreds of uncials in cuneiform, lectionaries, quotes for the fathers, to where you can trace every line of the New Testament, every word of the New Testament, and see which particular manuscripts in the tree of manuscripts. And there are families of manuscripts as the tree grows, because if you were a church around Constantinople, you would most likely use the particular Bible or manuscript that the church at Constantinople used. So that family called the Eastern Text, another group of strong bishops had their particular one down at Alexandria, and then the so-called Western Stream. And you can trace these families of manuscripts and every word in the New Testament analyzed. There is no book in the history of mankind that has had as many opponents and as many scholars rip at it, tear at it, analyze every word, every manuscript in the history of mankind. And we dig out 13 manuscripts at Nag Hammadi, and it hasn't had even 20 years. The scholars so fought over firstness that it wasn't even published. How do you equate that without 2,000 years of analysis and examination and critique? How do you equate that unless you have a priori agenda you're trying to promote? This is not a mindless endeavor. Christianity does not ask you to park your brain. Christianity is based upon a fact and will stand the test, as it has for 2,000 years, for honest minds who take a look. And with that, into the resurrection. It either happened or it didn't. Now, if you're going to talk about the resurrection of Jesus and going to do it in an intelligent way, it demands disciplined breakdown of the facts. And it demands a distinction between what you must take for granted first before you get to the subject. You're going to discuss whether or not the message I preach today, when I'm done, is too long. You have to assume that we're here and that I preached. There's little sense in discussing whether I preached too long if you're in doubt of whether or not this meeting occurred. You were here, and I'm up here moving my mouth. Don't get into a debate whether I preach too long, and then when you're losing the debate, say, well, he wasn't even there. There was somebody else that preached. You follow? That's known as frame of reference. A frame of reference is what you take for granted, stand on, and move forward. Frame of reference is something you're not debating or arguing. You're assuming it as you proceed with other things. I assume, for example, frame of reference I operate under is that gravity works. There are lots of activities I would change. and approach real carefully. If I didn't have the frame of reference, the expectancy, gravity will work. When I get out of bed in the morning, the thought does not cross my mind. Will my feet hit the ceiling or the floor? I know. I'm going to hit the floor. Not so with those guys up there in the spaceship. I know when I reach for a glass of water and hold it up here, it's going to go down there. I'm not going to go up there. Now, I'm being ludicrous. But if you're going to approach the resurrection, certain other things must be taken for granted. I don't want to have to debate them. At the same time I'm debating the resurrection, I don't want to even talk about the resurrection unless these other things are taken for granted. One, Jesus lived. Now that's been debated. Not much anymore. What kind of Jesus was he is the debate now. But even Tacitus, the heathen Latin historian, recognized Jesus lived. Number two, he was crucified. At the hands of the Romans, at the instigation of Jewish leaders. Now that's part of the agenda, because it's the culture moving in on fixed ideas. Assumed by the Jesus Seminar that somehow or other Christianity, to be palatable, has to erase the Jewish leaders brought about the death of Christ. Because in today's world, and because of a lot of expansion of that idea into cruel treatment of the Jews through the centuries, let's erase the fact that the Jews did it. The Jews, that's part of this KCET program. The Romans did it, not the Jews. Well, the Jews didn't do it. And the Jewish leaders didn't do it because they were Jews. The Jewish leaders did it because power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and their position was threatened. It's the corruption of authority that made the Jewish leaders do what they did. But the Jewish leaders brought about his crucifixion. Like it or lump it. I don't really... I mean, Jesse Jackson and I are friends. But don't try to make me do penance for America's slavery. I wasn't here, and I never had any slaves. And don't reverse racism because I happen to be white in America and hold me accountable for slavery. How about lining up a few black chiefs of tribes in Africa who provided the slaves? This is not a race issue. Slavery is horrible. And it's been done down through the centuries. And that doesn't make it right. Don't blame the Germans of today for the Holocaust, except for those that try to deny it existed. Those are the ones I worry about. If they try to deny the Holocaust, they worry me. It happened. But a little blonde-haired German baby born in a hospital in Munich should not have to do penance his whole life for the evil of Hitler. He should never forget it as an evil that occurred. But he should not personally have to pay penance for what generations earlier did. We don't have to rewrite history to face the truth. All Jews did not participate. Jesus was a Jew. His mother was a Jew. His disciples were a Jew. And the worst thing that happened is there were thousands of Jews that were ignoring it while it was happening, who would have fought against it if they'd been more aware. And the first Christians and disciples were Jews. And out of the Jew came the righteous seed by which the whole world is blessed. But Jewish leaders at that particular time brought about his crucifixion. And as I said earlier, at least I admire them. They understood with their hard-headed monotheism that to claim to be God was blasphemous, and he had to be lying, and he was a blasphemer because it couldn't be true. And they brought about his crucifixion. Jewish leaders staked their reputation by accusing him of blasphemy. He was considered dead. Didn't say he was dead. He was considered dead. They took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb. Not only considered dead, buried in a known tomb. That's very important. The tomb was known. Buried in a known tomb. Number five, he was preached, raised, ascended. Am I boring you? He was preached, raised, ascended, and the tomb empty. And that's not E.T., I want to go home, that's empty tomb. Now, if you take these facts, I'm not going to debate these facts. All I want to say to you, it's much easier to prove any one of these facts than to prove the resurrection. Because these, none of these are impossible on their face. But to discuss the resurrection, I'll take anybody on these questions. It's much easier to demonstrate and prove than the resurrection. These, I assume, before I talk to anybody about the resurrection. The Jewish leaders, if they brought about, through their accusations, his crucifixion, accusing him of blasphemy, where do they stand as religious leaders if he comes out of the tomb? It's not a matter of intellectual interest. It's a matter of bread and butter and life. If he came out of the tomb, their reputation, their life as religious leaders came into instant jeopardy. They were the frauds. As Peter said, you desired a murderer to be granted unto you and killed the Prince of Life. Pretty hard to retain your position as a religious leader if that charge is true. Thus, they had more interest in disproving this message than you and I 2,000 years later. More interest in disproof, the Jewish leaders. And because of that, the disciples were persecuted for the message. Now, I know later they became the target and the scapegoat for the empire's ills. But at the beginning, every record has them persecuted for preaching the resurrection message. All they had to do to stop the persecution was shut up about the resurrection. Don't preach this message anymore. Peter says, do we obey God or man? You killed him, but God raised him up. Prison, beheading in the case of James, not James, the so-called brother, the other James. The disciples were persecuted for preaching this message, instigated because the Jewish leaders who brought about his crucifixion by their charges, their position was threatened if the message be true. Eight, as a fact I'm assuming, the tomb was empty. Empty tomb. Logic requires it. If you accept Jewish leaders brought about the crucifixion, they're more concerned than anybody to disprove the resurrection message. He was buried in a known tomb. All they have to do to disprove the message is go to the tomb, produce the body, and they had enough interest to walk over there and do it. Logic tells me the tomb had to be empty. Otherwise, they would have gone to the tomb, produced the body, and that would have ended it then and there. Furthermore, history tells me it wasn't until centuries, long after the Gospels were circulated, that anybody showed any interest in where the tomb was. Nobody cared. He had risen. He was coming again. He was vindicated. He cared about the tomb. It wasn't until relics became important to the Catholic Church or the medieval churches that they began to try to figure out, well, where was the tomb? The Jewish leaders knew. First century people knew. They went there as soon as the Sabbath, which was the high Sabbath of the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, they went there instantly and found the stone rolled away. But then it disappeared from history. Until today, you go to Jerusalem, they're still fighting over two locations. The historic churches, the straddle one site, and then Gordon, who's much more convincing, in my judgment, made it his passion to find the tomb that's just off behind where the Greyhound, where the bus station, not the Greyhound, the bus station used to be, and there's a skull-like hill right above it that has been preserved because it was an Arab graveyard, and it sits there towering in the heart of Jerusalem, and off around is a garden and the tomb that Gordon located. And so now today, the churches, more Orthodox, go to the site of the great churches and say that's where he was buried. And then Gordon's tomb, where most of the evangelical Protestants go, is another one which I think has more historic credence than the one that the churches sit on. But there's two. Nobody knows which one. Because it was lost to history. Because there's no body in it. Only later did they begin to, well, where is that tomb? Mary knew. The disciples knew. The Jewish leaders knew. And they didn't go there and produce the body, which is proof positive it was empty. It was the tomb of a rich man, Joseph of Arimathea, a member of the Sanhedrin, and also, as Jerome calls him in the Latin, minister of mines, who had access to both Pilate and the Sanhedrin that could bring him down, lay him in that tomb, and it was empty. Those facts, if you don't want to believe those, that's much easier to prove than the resurrection. On those facts, I discuss the resurrection. There have been various theories. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Various theories to explain this resurrection message. The first one, the Jewish leaders, the Gospels say, came up with it to explain the fact of the empty tomb. Because of their concern to disprove it. Otherwise, they are made out to be frauds themselves. They say the disciples stole the body. While we slept. Now, there's an interesting record in Matthew's Gospel of the high priest going to Pilate and saying, this criminal had said things about raising from the dead. And to make sure that his body is not stolen and some fraud perpetrated, put a guard there. And Pilate, not as clear in the King James, you need to read all the versions, you've got 26. Pilate refused him essentially. He said, you have a guard, put it there, the temple guard, that had been on duty practically 24 hours since Jesus was arrested. Pilate said, you got a guard. Because I'm telling you, if Roman soldiers had slept, they'd be killed. Just that simple. They put temple guard there. And when they come running to the high priest to report that they went to sleep, and when they woke up, the stone was rolled away, and Jesus' body was gone. The record Matthew has that they gave these guards large sums of money to tell a lie. And they also said, if it gets to the governor, we in essence will cover for you in this manner. And the lie was, the disciples stole the body. That's why the tomb's empty. Number two, the Jewish leaders, another theory, is the Jewish leaders took the body. Now that's so stupid on its face. That's equivalent to committing religious suicide. If they took the body, well, let me go on with the theories. There have been some pretty stupid theories to try to get around the fact this message has been preached. The Romans took the body. What they were going to do with it, I don't know. Croson says he was just thrown out on a trash pile and dogs ate his body. Romans took it. He revived. I can't spell resuscitation, so I put revived. He was not dead, considered dead. And when he got in the coolness of the tomb, he resuscitated. Now that ought to have been a scene trying to get out of those grave clothes. And pushing the stone away. But he resuscitated. Number five, the women went to the wrong tomb. In the nighttime, dusk time, dawn time, whatever your choice, when they went there, it wasn't clear enough to see good. And they thought they went to Jesus' tomb, but they went to the wrong tomb. And it was truly empty, they were honest, but he was never in it. Because wrong tomb. Hallucinations. Glorified daydreams. They thought they saw these things, but in fact they didn't. Lies. They've made the whole thing up. They were so devastated by his death, they had bet on the wrong Messiah, and they had to somehow save face. And that's why they waited 7 weeks to tell the story. Because it took them that long to make up the story, and they just fraudulently told the whole lies. He was a fraud and a nut, and should have been killed, but they'd bet on him. Now they're going to be a fraud. So it's all lies. Or number eight, proof. They're simply honest reporters reporting what they saw and experienced. Now, I could spend 7 more weeks on each theory. We don't have to. There's only 2 choices, just like you only got 2 choices here. A nut or a fraud or God, what he claimed to be. Only 2 choices, true or lying. There ain't nothing in between. Because what they preached was resurrection, ascension, empty tomb. All 3. The disciples stole the body. Well, they're liars. So I don't have to waste time on that, do I? Jewish leaders took the body. Totally untenable. If you assume these facts. Because they would say, hey, we took the body. What is this stupid story? We got the body. We got witnesses of where we disposed of it, or we can produce it. It's untenable, but it does nothing to explain ascension. It explains the empty tomb. It does not do anything to explain the ascension or the detailed resurrection appearances where they took a fish together, they cooked fish on the shore. If the Jewish took the body, or if the Jewish leaders took the body, they sure embellished the story. They're liars. The Romans took the body, totally untenable. With the unrest, they would have said, hey, shut these people up, we took the body. But even if tenable, it does nothing to explain anything other than the empty tomb. It doesn't explain ascension, or the resurrection appearances. They're still making up stories, revived, resuscitated. Untenable, you don't resuscitate from a Roman crucifixion, particularly when you add the sword in the side. But if he resuscitated, it ain't a resuscitated, emaciated, half-dead Jesus they preach and talk about. It's alive, vital, amazing, unbelievable, resurrected Christ. And again, it would explain the empty tomb. A different kind of Jesus in the appearances is preached, but even if I give them that, they're still lying about the ascension. It doesn't take into account the whole message. These people, from the beginning, preached a total message. Resurrection, empty tomb, ascension. Wrong tomb. Well, again, Jewish leaders, known tomb, go to the right tomb. That one's exploded, but it's still untenable because it only explains the empty tomb. It doesn't explain ascension and resurrection stories. Hallucinations? Any psychology major or professional listening knows there's a prior state of mind as a condition precedent to hallucinations. Theirs was the exact opposite of what ought to be. But the hallucination theory has exploded with the fact of the empty tomb. Those daydreams are gone in an instant, and the concern of the Jewish leaders would have gone to the tomb, and the empty tomb blows hallucinations away. We're down to lies or truth. People don't like to be boxed in. I remember as a history major, I used to hate so-called objective historians. Objective historians is a non-existent situation. You can't be a historian and be objective. You can be an objective reporter, being truthful and honest about where your bias lies. But psychological certainty is such that exposure to facts drives you to a conclusion. You ultimately are fenced in by the facts. If you're not exposed, you can remain agnostic, uncertain, and ignorant. But exposure brings conviction. Objective historians are those who have strong opinions, will tell you what they are, so you're warned of where they lie, and then can present the facts without trying to interpret that they have an opinion. There ain't no such thing as a non-opinionated historian, unless he's stupid. You have an opinion. When you look at things, you're forced to either or. When you look at the only Christ, you're forced to this either or. And if you don't recognize that, you're unlearned. Or just plain stubborn and with an agenda that all your own you're trying to prove in spite of the facts. Don't bother me with the facts, I know what ought to be. But you're ignorant. The facts drive you in a corner. People don't like that. But the facts are, the issue of the resurrection boils down to the witnesses, to the reporters. Just like a criminal trial. Who's telling the truth? And these early disciples, and as I said last Sunday, the Christian message started with these claims. It wasn't added later, despite the denials of the founder. This was the first message. This is how it burst out on the scene. They're either lying or telling the truth. And for these reasons, I came to the conclusion, once I was cornered, that all this is just rhetorical BS. Either these witnesses made this story up to save face for having bet on the wrong Messiah, or they're honest reporters. And how can I tell? Well, number one, internal evidence is in the report. Let's look at that. Historians have a way of sniffing in the documents themselves for internal evidence of veracity. Whether or not they sound truthful or whether they sound artful in lying, Let's look at some of the internal evidence. You go to three Gospels to find all the facts of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. And in the three Gospels, you find the following things. Jesus says to Philip, "Where can we buy bread?" Why Philip? You have to go to another Gospel to find that Philip was born in that area, near Bethsaida. One Gospel, he says, "Where can we buy bread?" Another Gospel, you find that he specifically asked Philip. Another Gospel, you find Philip was from the area of Bethsaida, in another context. All of a sudden, it makes sense. Chances are, since they were at the area near Bethsaida, and Philip was from that area, chances are, of the three different records, the one that is saying he asked Philip is telling the truth. And the others are telling the truth because all three parts of the puzzle make the complete picture. Again and again, you find those little hidden indices of truth. People who are trying to record facts as they were, rather than making a story up. If they're just frauds, they're going to make a story up. Of all the Gospels that make Peter look the worst, it's Mark's Gospel. Mark makes Peter look worse than all the other Gospels. Now here is the giant of the church who preaches the message on the day the church is born. And yet, in Mark's Gospel, his mistakes and sins are magnified beyond any gospel. Now, link that with the fact that Mark was Peter's protege. Mark failed on the missionary journey to Turkey. And hard-nosed Paul sent him back. Mark ran away. He's the young man who lost his garment and ran away the night of the crucifixion. Now he's running away again, facing the hardships of Turkey. Barnabas, his relative, takes him under his wing, feels sorry for him, and Paul sends him back. Tough drill sergeant. But it's Peter who ultimately takes Mark under his arm and has Mark with him, and develops Mark until Paul can say in his aged years, "Send Mark. He's good for me." Peter, I can imagine, now this is imagination, I can imagine that Mark must have many times, as he was getting it together, said to Peter, "How can God forgive me? Because all I've been good at is quitting and running. All I've been good at is failing." And I can almost hear Peter saying, "Mark, let me tell you what I did the night that Jesus was betrayed. Let me tell you how Jesus singled me out after the resurrection and said, 'Go tell my disciples and Peter.' And I still, at the lake, when he promised to come to Galilee because he was late, I said, 'Let's go fishing.' And he still singled me out on the shore and said, 'Peter, lovest thou me more than these?' If you think, Mark, you can't be forgiven, look at me. And yet I was allowed by God to preach the message that birthed the church. Mark owed a debt to Peter. Why not paint it a little better? Why would we not find? And we know, beyond question, that Peter was the first-hand source of information for Mark that is the first gospel that's written. So why wouldn't Mark shade it a little? If he's just a liar, why wouldn't he shade it and make his mentor look better instead of making him look the worst? Why not Matthew, who was there when Peter did it? make Peter look the worst? Why not the disciples who were competitors with Peter? Yet Mark, his son in the Lord, later to be strength to Paul, paints the most graphic, detailed picture of Peter's failure. That's an internal evidence. I'll tell the truth, even though it hurts. The man I love the most, my teacher, Peter. These are just internal indices. Mark sends them on him. Everybody agrees, in spite of what this KCET thing says, Mark wrote his gospel either at Rome after he came to see Paul or at Alexandria. He wrote it not for Jews. He wrote it for Gentiles, Romans or Egyptians. And he, of all the Gospels, is writing to prove that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, that this suffering Messiah, spoken of by prophets that they don't know about, the Gentiles, was the Son of God. Now, if he were writing to Jews, there is no messianic name he could use more divine in its implications than Son of Man. Because if he's writing to the Jews, at that particular period when they were under persecution, the apocryphal books were the apocalyptic books were the most popular of what they read. Enoch and Daniel, where the Messiah is portrayed and the name that's used is the Son of Man coming in clouds of glory to set up his kingdom. But you're writing to Gentiles, and you want to prove that Jesus is Son of God, and you're a liar with no morality about it. You're a fraud. You're making up the story, and you want to prove to Gentiles who never heard of Enoch, never heard of Daniel, that Jesus is Son of God. Why not have him refer to himself as Son of God? Count it. Mark's gospel is the smallest, but he has Jesus refer to himself as Son of Man more than any other gospel. What? He's a liar. Just change one word. Every time Jesus calls himself Son of Man, put in Son of God. Internal evidence, I'm going to report it truthfully and say what Jesus said and did, even if it hurts my case. Jesus said, Son of Man. In his context, it had divine implication. To the Gentiles I'm writing to, it has human implication. But it's what he said, it's what I'm going to write. That sounds like truth. Am I boring you? Guards at the tomb. This is one of Morrison's points. If they're liars, it would help their story to say there were guards at the tomb and they saw Jesus split out. Now they got actual witnesses to the resurrection. That makes a good story. I mean, witnesses not just to the resurrection having happened and Jesus running around alive, but they're seeing him come through the rock or move it. Now, if you're a liar, I mean, you ought to read some of the things that these Gnostic Gospels that Croson thinks are more reliable than the Synoptic Gospels. You ought to read some of the things they talk about. I mean, wow, you'll understand why the Church Fathers decided they shouldn't be canonized. But, you know, this ain't stretching it too much. You're going to proclaim a miracle. And if you're going to make up the story that guards are there, why not have them wait to see it happen? What does it serve to have guards there that can verify the resurrection and asleep? Now, come into the frame of reference. If it's a lie, it ain't a very good one. I mean, I'm smart enough to figure out, if I'm going to have guards there to verify the resurrection, don't let them sleep. And if you're making the whole story up, you can just make up guards that stayed awake just as easy as making up guards that sleep. And come on now, internal evidence. If he can raise from the dead, couldn't he move a rock? Come on. Go read every record. Every record. The stone was removed from the outside. In one record, an angel came down and moved the stone. But every record, without exception, the rock was moved from the outside. And it was a giant stone that some who went to the tomb worried about how they could get in. The rock was moved from outside. Now, if you're telling a lie that includes the resurrection and miracles galore, wouldn't it improve the lie to have him explode out of that tomb and the rock roll over a guard or two? Huh? Internal evidences of stick to the facts. As my dad used to say, the rock was moved to let people in to see that it was gone, not to let him out. He came out. And by the way, in the Gospel of the Hebrews, there's a phrase that verifies, it's not in other records, the Gospel of Hebrews, this one of these proto-Matthews, there is a record where Jesus, when he came out of the tomb, went first to the servant of the priest and handed him his linen cloth that he'd been wrapped in. Then he appeared to James. Nobody knows who that servant of the priest is that he gave the linen cloth to. The only servant of the priest that was at the gate or at the tomb was the guard, or guards. The priest, not Pilate, used the temple guard to guard the tomb. Now, that sounds pretty good to me. Jesus comes out with his garment in his hand and says, "Here, guard, see ya." That's not included in the Synoptic Gospels. That's a much better story. You following what I'm saying? They don't sound like liars. They sound like people who are telling the truth. Finally, on this point, and there's many others, I'm just skipping along, the 7 weeks. Anybody smart enough to propound this tale as a fraud is smart enough to know waiting 7 weeks to start it ain't smart. Again, the 7 weeks looks like honest people. He was dead. They believed that. They were Christ. They didn't believe he'd raise. He raises. It's unbelievable. Now they can believe anything he says. He said, you're going to preach, but don't preach until you wait 7 years. 7 weeks until you're endued with power. They're not trying to concoct a story. They do exactly what he says now. They go to that upper room. And they stay there for 7 weeks, waiting until the day of Pentecost, on the Feast of Pentecost. Sounds like truthful, honest people, not crooks. That's one of the reasons. Two, cataclysmic change. I believe telling a lie can change people, but not for the good. Every one of these tellers of the tale became better, and they're cataclysmically changed. Peter cannot be counted on to not betray, not give way to fear, and not deny his Lord before his death. Peter, everywhere you go through the Gospels, you find big nets of his personality. He's impetuous. He's changeable. He's extreme. When Jesus is washing feet, Peter says, "You're not going to wash mine. If I can't wash your feet, you're not going to be in my kingdom. Wash me all over." Extremists. Everywhere. It's always Peter. If Jesus talks to the cross, "Be it far from you. Get behind me, Satan." He's Satan's mouthpiece. A few minutes after, he was the Holy Spirit's mouthpiece, proclaiming Jesus the Son of God. When Jesus talks to somebody betraying Him, not me, Lord. They can kill me, I won't deny you. Extremists. Jesus never said He had to die. Somebody's going to betray me. Well, it's not me. They can kill me. I won't do it. Before the cock crows three times, you'll deny me three times. Before the cock crows, you'll deny me three times. And He flees into the darkness. And I've already said, Jesus sends a special message to Him. But when they get to Galilee, and Jesus is late, I go fishing, Peter says. Unstable, extreme, impetuous, after the resurrection, a rock of faith, has to be delivered from his Jewish legalistic tendencies, but he is a rock clear to his death, the rock on which the whole Western church rest its case. Cataclysmic change for good. For telling a lie? James, or rather John. John's one of those brothers that are called sons of thunder. Selfish, high-tempered. When somebody opposes them, they're going to call fire from heaven down on them. Fighting with the other disciples for the best seats in the kingdom. And chickens. Send their mother to ask for it. Suddenly, this son of thunder, high-tempered slayer of men who oppose him, becomes in everybody's judgment the apostle of love above all the other disciples. He radiates love from the New Testament pages. So you have instability to faith. You have anger, wrath, judgment, harshness, son of thunder, to disciple of love. Then you get to Thomas. Now these are personalities, the big nets of which are hidden in these and inobtrusively just crop out of these different Gospels that are supposed to be a product of liars. And by the way, I can dismiss the Jesus seminar and the KCET thesis in a stroke because they're saying that all of this was made up to serve the situations of the time and either written by people who lied and said they were Matthew, Mark, and Luke when they weren't, or written by people who had to construct a Jesus that would serve their situation. In both cases, they're liars. Don't even have to treat that. We're dealing with liars, and basically, the reason the Jesus Seminar has no trouble calling them good people, even though they're changing the record, is that's what they want to do. They think they're good people changing the record, so how can these people be bad for doing what they're trying to do, create a Jesus that will fit the 20th century of their creation? So therefore, they project themselves onto these New Testament writers and said they created a Jesus that would fit their mold. Well, that makes them liars, just like these modern academics. Liars. A disgrace to the name academic. I'm about done. Thomas. Hidden through these pages, Thomas is always the one who's doubting. On one occasion, Jesus faces a dangerous journey through Samaria. Thomas, of all the 12, speaks up and says, "It's dangerous, but let us go with him, that we may die also." Courage and love, but humanism. He actually expected Jesus might be killed on that journey, and he wanted to be at his side to die with him. That's a human view of Christ. To Thomas, it's dangerous. Jesus got blood that can run like anybody else, and he might die. Even though Jesus said, "No man taketh his life, shepherd lays it down." Jesus is preaching on another occasion. Spread through these records. And Jesus is speaking of, I'm going to go away. I'm going to go to a place and prepare mansions for you. And then I'm going to come back and get you and take you to be with me. Now, all the disciples are listening. I'm sure they're having a Channel 40 fit. Mansions. 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 They don't hear another word Jesus says. But hard-headed realist Thomas is listening. And Jesus says the next line, whither I go, you know, and the way you know. While these others are having their hallelujah fit about the mansions, Thomas butts in rudely and says, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Hard-headed realist. Now, crucifixion. Who is it, when the reports of the resurrection come in, that says, I'm not going to believe it. I won't believe it until I can put my hand in the print of the nails and into his side where the spear pierced. Thomas, this is genius. To hide these personality vignettes and make it come out with different records written in different places by liars. And Jesus appears. And Thomas, Jesus says to him, it's more blessed to believe without seeing, which is an axiomatic statement. You don't have to worry about questions. But he offered to submit to the very test, to hold my hands and my side. And Thomas falls to his knees, my Lord and my God. Never to doubt again. Cataclysmic change. Piercing the Himalayas, to be pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India, taking the gospel to the most philosophic seedbed of thought in the then-known world, where Vedanta and Buddhism sprang forth, Thomas, never to doubt again. Cataclysmic change from instability to the rock, from intolerance anger and judgment, son of thunder, to love. From doubt to unwavering faith. That's a change for the good. If there is no God, that's a change for the good. Lies don't cause that cataclysmic change. And the same kind of change for the good, instantly and cataclysmically, with a group. As I pick three, all happening on the after side of the same event. They start telling this story, they are changed. Three, you don't pay the price, the persecution that they paid for a lie. The price, too much for a lie. Four of them crucified. Mark dragged to death by idolatrous priests in the streets of Alexandria. Luke hanged from an olive tree. Four of them crucified. Peter upside down. St. Andrew on St. Andrew's cross. Everyone save John suffered terrible persecuted death. Bartholomew flayed to death with a whip in Armenia. James the Last crucified. Flayed means skinned alive with a whip. You don't pay that kind of price for a lie. And all you got to do is, hey, I made it up. You don't pay that price for a lie. And the issue is, are they lying? Or telling the truth. And St. Thomas Aquinas, great proof of the resurrection, added to that, they paid this price alone. Now, I can imagine that if a group propounds a lie to save face for having made a commitment in a certain direction, as long as they stay together as a group, there is that horizontal pressure not to be the one who breaks rank. But now scatter us. We're telling a lie, trying to save face. Craig, you're Bartholomew. You're up in Armenia. Buddy, you're Thomas. You're over in India. Mike, you are Peter. You're in Rome. There's no TV, no fax machines, no telephone, no satellites. The chances are you have no expectancy, since you're telling a lie. This isn't going to be some miracle ministry. Chances are you have no expectancy of ever seeing Peter or Thomas again. You're in Armenia. You have no expectancy of ever seeing Peter, or rather, you're Peter, ever seeing Thomas, and you're our Bartholomew. You're in Armenia. You're in Rome. You're over in India. Himalaya separates you. Now, each one of you are alone. And you're going to suffer this persecution for the lie you're telling. All you've got to do to keep from being skinned alive with a whip is say, didn't happen. And since you're a liar anyway, catch the next boat to Rome, and you run into Mike there, and you say, boy, I'm telling you, I almost converted Armenia single-handedly. And I've left several associates there to carry on the ministry. Any way I can help you here, Peter? Come on, use some common sense. It is psychologically inconceivable that these men in disparate regions of the world would suffer this persecution and not one of them break rank somewhere and say, it wasn't true. You find one. Nowhere will you find any one of these tellers of the story suffering horrible persecution ever saying anything other than it happened. It's psychologically inconceivable that they would die alone under the conditions they died for telling such a message and it be a lie. I remember Larry Thomas, my major prophet at Stanford in the doctoral program, saying to me when I finished a presentation to him in private of these, he says, Gene, I'm convinced. I'm convinced these disciples believed what they were telling. I am convinced that they believed it was true. Therefore, one of your other eight facts must be false. I knew I had him. It was my joy in later years to learn that Larry, before he passed on, became a devout Catholic, which at the very least requires a belief in the resurrection, and abandoned his experimentalism. When I first went there, I remember him weeping at the end of the year in Social Philosophies of Education as he presented what he called the ontology of experimentalism, carrying John Dewey's philosophy even further, and how our only existence is a wave in the sea, but the impact we can have on the ocean. He abandoned it and became a believer. I hope that that day long ago stirred him to a search that will lead you, as it led me one day, to laying the book down and saying, there is no other explanation. He came out of that tomb. Well, then what? These other claims I preached last Sunday are therefore true, including the one, I'll never leave you nor forsake you. Once I cross that hurdle of the resurrection, no trouble for me to say, well, his presence, invisible, is there. I better start orienting my life to the most important audience, that invisible one that never leaves me or forsakes me. I don't have any trouble believing that, if I can believe the resurrection. Nor do I have any trouble believing that He'll keep His promise, that as I trust Him, He will put into me, for want of a better way to say it, a piece of Himself, God's own nature, until we become dual creatures. The old man dying and a new creature after His own image, which as I keep my grip of faith on God, that new man can slowly, imperceptibly, more that others may see than I can see, displace that old nature, and more, that indwelling Spirit that raised up Christ from the dead can create in me and in you a new creature in Christ Jesus. That's my message for today. Offering time. Remember next Sunday, homecoming at King's House 1, not here. Sing that same song again, John. Joy in the morning. Good day, folks.